Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
All right, welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast, and we have a particularly exciting one today. In my freshman year of college, we went to the Cinéma du Parc to watch a new movie. 2.5 hours later, we came out, and somebody asked where to go for dinner, and I said, they got Danish there. So some of you all picked up that the movie, of course, was Martin Scorsese's brilliant movie, Goodfellas. And a longtime friend of the blog and King Crimson Head, and more importantly, former editor-in-chief of Premiere and current film critic for The New York Times and RogerEbert.com, Glenn Kenny, has a fantastic new book out about Goodfellas called Made Men. I'll hold up, even though I think this will only be audio, but no, just in case you put that up there. And we're so excited that Glenn will be joining us to talk about this movie, which, if anything, looks better than it ever has several decades later. I guess I just wanted to, and I should say joining us are my colleagues, Eric Loomis, professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, and current target, once again, of various Wingnut Welfare campus reform operations, and Paul Campos, professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder, currently going through its own COVID-related and football-related crises. Although I guess no football with Pac-12 is one of the last holdouts, so maybe we'll save that anyway. But we will all be discussing this book. And so, Glenn, I guess I wanted to start off, before we start talking about the movie and the details and everything you came up with in this book, I wanted to just start off talking about, what was the genesis of this project? Obviously, you were able to get a lot of interviews, including with Scorsese himself and several of the major actors, including Robert De Niro. What was the genesis of this project, and what made you want to do a book-length project on this movie?
Well, there's a two-pronged answer to that. But before I start, let me make a slight correction. I was not the editor-in-chief of Premiere. If I had been, I probably would be dead today. I was the chief film critic and senior editor. My editors in chief were, in this order, James B. Meigs, Michael Solomon, and Peter Herbst. Those were my bosses, who I each drove somewhat insane to different degrees. And who indulged me to a degree that I didn't know how good I had it. But so the reason this book came into being is kind of two-pronged. First of all, I wanted to do a book. Many years ago, my friends Adrian Miller and Joe Veltri, I was dining with them. Adrian is a very great writer. She was the fiction editor at Esquire and has written a fantastic book about her time there called In the Land of Men that came out in February. Fantastic book. And she's such an amazing person and has been a great friend to myself and my wife, Claire, for many years. Her husband, Joseph Veltri, is an agent at Gersh, and we were having dinner one night. And Joseph just said to me, Glenn, you're a really good writer. Do you have an agent? I'm like, no. And we began working together, and we tested the waters. What kind of I've written fiction, I've written nonfiction, but if you're trying to write nonfiction books in today's publishing world, and by today's publishing world I mean the publishing world of the last 20 years or so, unless you're affiliated with the New Yorker or something like that, it's just not an automatic thing that you can just sort of write your own ticket in terms of getting a book out there. You have to come up with ideas. You have to make very elaborate proposals. You have to do sample chapters, and then you have to get it out there. And then you get a series of, well, this sounds fantastic, I hope someone publishes it, notices from various publishers. I spent a huge amount of time doing a proposal for a non-film book about the evolution of Times Square from 1975 to 1997, which someone at a crime-oriented imprint had actually semi-commissioned. And once I turned the proposal in, said, well, it's too grim. I'm like, what do you mean? And then somebody else said, well, there aren't enough dead prostitutes in it. And I'm not going to go back in time and become a murderer for the sake of selling my book. And these are all different problems and different issues that happen. the Goodfellas thing seemed like a great idea because I was sort of not present at the creation of Goodfellas, but as a journalist, my first exposure to Martin Scorsese in person was during the editing of Goodfellas. I was working in a magazine called Video Review, a fascinating magazine that existed in the 80s and could never exist either before the 80s or after the 80s because it was a consumer, not a trade magazine, but a consumer magazine devoted to home video hardware and software. Think about it. You had test reports on Laserdisc players. You know, we got the big... Our idea of a big exclusive scoop, and this was a real thing at the time, it sounds funny now, but when Mitsubishi created the first 35-inch cathode ray tube television, we were the first ones to test it. This was our thing. I worked at this place from like 1986 to 1990, and it was a lot of fun, actually. I had a great time, we got to see the first surround sound system, which was like a huge three amplifier behemoth that you had to hook up and took hours to do. We got the first NEC cartridge system. It was just great. We got the Criterion Collection stuff when it was all Laserdisc. So that was my job, and we are celebrating our 10th anniversary, and the publisher of the magazine, who was a lunatic, he was one of those guys who would like turn into Godzilla when he lost his temper, and people would literally hide under their desks when he started screaming. I thought I told you to get that Fisher out, you know, that sort of thing. He wanted a lot of very famous writers to contribute to this 10th anniversary issue. I was one of the editors in charge of it, and I got Dave Barry. He did a great essay. We tried to get Matt Groening to do a Life in Hell graphic, but we couldn't meet his price. And, you know, and then we got on the phone with J.G. Ballard and Marguerite Duras and got little sound bites from them. And I thought, well, why not have Scorsese talk about, we had this copy editor who spoke fluent French. And I think being a copy editor was his front for being in the CIA, frankly. And he volunteered to call Paris to talk to Marguerite Duras. I'm like, okay. So I thought, let's go to Scorsese because he's been, you know, touting film preservation since Raging Bull came out. And, you know, eventually this led to his organizations, his nonprofits like the Film Foundation and the World Cinema Foundation, which are doing amazing work to this day and just getting more exciting all the time. And let's talk to Scorsese about the intersection of home video and cinephilia. And he was totally into it. And he wasn't writing, you know, he was editing the film. So that was suggested, go come to his office, talk to him, you know, take notes, record it, mold it into an essay. He'll look at it, sign off on it, and it's you're as told to, only you don't say as told to because that's not how it works. I'm like, that's fine. I'm fine with that. I will, my ego is happy to be subsumed in this project. And I went to his office in the Brill Building, which was, you know, now a less famous place, but it used to be like the cynosure of pop music publishing, song publishing companies, and it's where you'd see Neil Diamond and Carol King and Jerry Goffin and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil all wrote the classic songs of the late 50s, early 60s there. He was on a floor of the Brill Building, and there was a editing bay elsewhere in the office, so he could in the building, so he could edit. And then, you know, and he was telling me about this movie he was finishing called Wise Guy, which was then title changed to Goodfellas after, you know, there was a television show of the same name on at the same time. And we had this lively chat about home video and cinephilia, but also the ways that this film was influenced by tabloid television and documentary television and by the old series, The Untouchables. He made very clear, I'm not talking about Brian's film, I'm talking about Robert Stack. I'm like, yeah, I get it. And because it had a kind of lurid quality and a momentum and immediacy, and he said, even the way I'm cutting this film now, even if it turns out to be a 2.5-hour movie, and it turned out to be pretty much exactly, I think it's 2 hours and 20 minutes movie, so this is going to be one of the fastest films ever made. That was his idea of doing it. So this intrigued me because, I mean, not just because, you know, I'd been a Scorsese fan for a very long time, and of course I was going to see every picture that came out. And when I did see it, I, you know, there was a few things about it that were different from his prior I found interesting, but I also loved it. So having not been there from the beginning, but having met him at that time, it seemed right for me to use that as a starting point and write a book about Goodfellas. You know, it was, you know, write the story of how it was made. And I had, you know, a few kind of critical models that I always look for. I always have been influenced by Robin Wood, who was not a behind the scenes kind of critic, but, you know, brought a lot to bear on his readings of individual films. And one thing that was interesting about Goodfellas too, was that its subtext was not that closely related to the subtext you find in Scorsese's other films, because it's in a way not as personal, or the way that it's personal is very different from his other films. The other thing that was interesting about it was that it did represent a turning point in his career. He became a big Hollywood filmmaker after that. Although, as we'll discuss, I hope, in the subsequent discussion, he still doesn't see himself that way. But it did change things for him a lot. So, and it's also a great movie, and it's a rich movie that you can, you know, that each scene has a lot of minutia that you can examine and bring to the forefront and find interesting things to say about it. One of the problems I had early on was saying, well, this is a movie that people have been writing about and talking about nonstop. What's the new thing you're going to bring to it? That was a pertinent question at first. But we did end up selling it. But then when we sold it, the contract didn't happen until March of 2019. They wanted the manuscript in March of 2020. So I didn't have a whole huge amount of time to do it. So it was that process became very interesting in and of itself too.
All right. Well, thank you. I guess I'll take the next question. And I think one of the kind of frustrating debates around this movie to me and around some of Scorsese's work is this kind of moralistic argument that he's glamorizing gangsters. And I don't personally see it that way. And I know you sort of discussed this to some extent in the book, but you know, it seems to me that people, when they come to his movies, not all people, but people who are not particular fans or people who have these critiques, you know, they seem to want to have a big bold message, you know, at the end that says gangsters bad or racism bad. And I think that we saw this in its own way with the ridiculous Scorsese versus Marvel Comics internet battle of 29 of whenever it was last year or earlier this year, where, you know, he kind of takes on a little bit the idea of the superhero movie and the kind of resistance and anger that led to. And I was just wondering about that, because Scorsese so often gets talked about as glamorizing, as amoral, et cetera. And, you know, I don't find the film to be that way.
Yeah, that's, you know, there's a whole kind of a new aesthetic forming. Maybe it's generational, or maybe it's just kind of blinkered, where there's this desire somehow to have art depict only positive emotions or positive perspectives, and moral ambiguity is frowned upon. And there's also this pernicious idea that depiction equals endorsement, and all those things kind of come into play when you're talking about various reactions to Scorsese's work over the years. And then when you get to the Marvel movies are, you know, their arguments about their cinematic value notwithstanding, and I don't think, well, never mind. But Marvel movies are kind of the epitome or ne plus ultra of the whole idea of saying, this is good, this is bad. You know, and even when they try to essay a morally ambiguous character, I guess the most successful they were was in Black Panther with the Killmonger character, who does, you know, who's kind of a murderous villain with a little bit of a both-sider-ish, you know, kind of edge. And that was done relatively well, but that's, you know, that's a thing. But, you know, yeah, Scorsese will not bring in somebody from off stage to say, this is bad, the way that, you know, Howard Hawks was kind of forced at the end of the film Scarface to have an execution scene, or to put in that preface, you know, that you know, it's not, you know, yeah, your movie's called Scarface, and then it's called Scarface, The Shame of a Nation. So Scorsese's not going to say Goodfellas, they're not really good, you know? It's just not what's happening. And yet, and you know, but there is a danger, and it's just something we have to live with, that people will take what you're doing completely the wrong way. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, there was a TikTok video that was, you know, circulated on Twitter of this, you know, 12 or 13 year old girl asking all her friends from boyfriends from school what their favorite movie is. And there's this procession of white, floppy haired, terrifying boys saying Wolf of Wall Street, you know. And as a 61 year old man, I'm conditioned to be terrified of young people. But, you know, there is this, you know, thing where, like, and I just did an audio commentary for The Wolf of Wall Street. And, you know, my partner on the commentary and I are sitting there watching it and thinking about this video. And we're about 2 hours into the movie and we're like, well, these are young kids. Maybe they fell asleep at this part, you know. You know, where you wreck, the car is wrecked and all this other shit. Like, where does their attention span fall off? Because it's very clear that this guy is going to ruination. And the irony is that there is, for guys like him, there is the second act in American Lives. That's the other thing that people don't take into account when they try to condemn Scorsese for moral relativism or moral or amorality, is that these films are making a point about life in America. You know, Goodfellas, to an even larger extent, Casino, and certainly Wolf of Wall Street. You know, Jordan Belfort should be a pariah, but because of his skill and because of what he represents to the very idea of capitalism, he's able to resurrect himself. And that's the critique. People don't recognize that as a critique, though, because they're so conditioned to this idea of success that they think it actually is a thing. So, you know, you get into a lot of complicated areas, but as I point out in my book, you know, Taxi Driver is not programmatically racist. You know, the depiction of black characters in the movie is not negative. There are kids on the street who, you know, who throw eggs at Bickle, and there's one guy walking down an avenue yelling to himself. But there's his fellow cabbie who's a pretty chill guy, and that's New York in the 70s. Everybody, black, white, Puerto Rican, what's the Prince line? Everybody just a freaking, he's from Minneapolis. But in New York, everybody was going nuts in the middle of Manhattan, if you ever went there. So, you know, there's that. And you know, in New York, Jimmy De Niro's character aspires to black artistry. You know, there's a whole subplot there. So, you know, there's a lot going on. But because people, you know, would like to insist that depiction equals endorsement, and because these figures of a certain moral repellence are being played by charismatic Hollywood actors, which is a theme that Manny Farber and Patricia Patterson got into with great vehemence in an essay about Taxi Driver called The Power and the Gory, there is, you know, there's this gray area. But as I point out in the book, you can get off the bus with these characters anytime. 2 minutes into the depiction of Henry Hill as an adult, he's shown as a racist who, you know, covers up for his crimes by trying to get the black guy by having one of his conspirators blame it on blacks. So that's right there. You know, you can choose how much you like this guy or want to like this guy after this. Now he's played by Ray Liotta. He's a pretty cool looking dude. He's, you know, he's slick, but he's very clearly a racist. They're all racists. They're homophobes. And also, they're sociopathic killers who, you know, just blow you away for not bringing them a drink fast enough. So, I mean, what do you need? What do you need in terms of bad? As Scorsese said to Terry Gross, who was trying to make this case that the opening tracking shot of The Irishman was in somehow a moral repudiation of the Coppa tracking shot in Goodfellas, Scorsese said, I know gangsters are bad. You don't have to tell me they're bad. But apparently he has to tell us they're bad by the lights of certain, you know, people. But, you know, what are you going to do? This has always happening in art, not just Scorsese's art. This is always happening in art. And, you know, we can't win this argument, but we just have to keep making it because it's dumb.
I just want to follow up a bit on that question. Speaking of something that's been happening forever, I'm reminded of how for a long time, a lot of critics were upset about the fact that Satan is like by far the most interesting character in Paradise Lost. And it this seemed sort of problematic in context of the supposed, ultimate message of the poem. Aesthetically, it is a real problem, but I'm wondering what thoughts you might have about the extent to which the intention of the auteur, of somebody like Scorsese, in this context is sort of inevitably distorted or derailed by a kind of social decadence or sociopathy, so that these characters who are supposed to be portrayed as essentially negative persons, even though, you know, complex in some ways, nevertheless end up being these kinds of sexy figures of admiration, with this problem just sort of getting intensified over time. I mean, it seems to me that if you look at something like The Sopranos, which is obviously very heavily influenced by Scorsese's treatment of the gangster world, or say Breaking Bad, there's just this problem that Tony Soprano, who obviously is a sociopath, and Walter White, who's a little bit more complicated in certain ways, but is ultimately a depraved figure, end up being these people that everybody somehow loves. And this isn't just something about movies. I'm reminded of a couple of things sort of from related areas. Michael Lewis, when he wrote Liar's Poker, was horrified to discover that he got all these letters from people who were asking him, how do I get a job at Solomon, basically? And then there's a very interesting book by this woman, Lauren Rivera, who's a sociologist, who just wrote a book a few years ago called Pedigree, which is all about how the American class system just totally rigs the game in terms of things like getting into Princeton. And of course, she ended up getting like hundreds of letters from people asking her, how do I get my child into Princeton, basically, even though that was the whole gravamen of the book was an attack on the class system. So I guess I'm just wondering about your thoughts on what an artist like Scorsese can really do in that context, given that his work ultimately ends up getting in some ways distorted to a really disturbing degree by the culture in which it moves through time.
This is actually something that's addressed explicitly in The Wolf of Wall Street, because Jordan Belfort is discussing being interviewed by Forbes, and then the Forbes piece that runs that nicknames him the Wolf of Wall Street is a huge hit piece. And then the day after, he's furious. And the day after,
he thinks the company's over.
Yeah,
right?
He thinks the company's over. The next day, 100, guys in Brooks Brothers suits are waving their resumes in the lobby. So, you know, Scorsese's aware of how this happens. As to what can be done, I don't know. But, you know, in a way, you know, what Milan Kundera said was that the artist, the novelist specifically in his phrase, but, you know, the job of the artist is to ask questions. And one question that Scorsese had and, had for a while, he's a great cinephile and, studied the classics that were, put forward by the auteurists of Cahiers du Cinéma and then later by Andrew Saras in his book, The American Cinema. So he watches the films of Howard Hawks, the films of John Ford. He's watching Scarface, the 1933 Scarface, Shame of a Nation, Howard Hawks film with his buddy Jay Cox, who's also a friend of mine, a very great guy, a screenwriter, worked with Scorsese on Gangs of New York, Age of Innocence, and Silence screenplays. And they're looking at the scene of Tony Camonte with a Tommy gun going, grunting like a Neanderthal while he's wielding a Tommy gun and shooting at the guys he's in a gunfight with and laughing. And Jay and Marty look at each other and they go, we love these guys. Why do we love these guys? In a sense, Goodfellas is asking that question, because it also is a question that goes back to Scorsese's childhood. This is not an autobiographical film in terms of its emotions in a way that Raging Bull was. Scorsese said to me, you know, Raging Bull was about me. I didn't know it. De Niro knew it, and that's why he forced me to do it, but I didn't find it out until I did it. And, you know, the ways that it's about him is in terms of Jake LaMotta's obsessions, his obsessions in terms of his boxing, but also his, you know, sexual obsessions, his jealousy, all that stuff. That's all a part of you know, Scorsese's personality that he doesn't talk about with journalists, but, you know, it's definitely there. When you see Jake LaMotta looking at Vicky at the pool, and there's that shot of her legs in close-up kicking in the water, this is Scorsese saying, I want you to see the way I see. This is the way I see this. So when you see, but it's different in Goodfellas, you know, Karen is the crazy jealous one. And a lot of the techniques that he uses in Raging Bull are used in scenes where Karen is going crazy about Henry's affair. But in the first scene, when after the killing of Billy Batts, when there's Chris Cerrone as young Henry Hill looking out the window down at the cab stand and the pizza parlor, he's got this beautiful green eye, and he's just looking down there with this sense of awe and wonder and not being able to partake. That is, in a sense, Scorsese as a child. He was very sickly with asthma. He couldn't go outside a lot. He wasn't athletic. Part of the reason he became a cinephile was because he just hung around at home and watched movies on Channel 9. He wasn't a reader at that point. And he was always looking outside to see what was going on. And sometimes what was going on involved guys in long Cadillacs, you know, beating up guys or hitting guys, you know. This was during the period where the mob underbosses protected the neighborhood to a certain extent, or, you know, played at protecting the neighborhood. A lot of this ties into the way that the Italian Americans were on lower rungs of the social ladder from the 19th century all the way into the 1950s and beyond. So that was his, that was the environment. And then the whole thing at the Copa, when he was constructing the scene, that long tracking shot, the Steadicam shot of them going into the Copa for the first time. He took a lot of input from the cinematographer and the first assistant director and the Steadicam operator. And in the end, when they tested the shot, his main thing was, you have to have the tables flying out faster, because that was his memory. This is the sense in which this is his memory play is very strong, because he used to go to the Copa as a teenager, and he was thinking, him and his buddies were seated, you know, back from the stage a bit, and there's this empty space between them and the stage. They're sitting there thinking, oh, we have great seats. And then 5 minutes before the show comes on, all the wise guys come in. And the waiters come in with their tables for two, holding them over their heads, flying in, setting them down. And then in 5 minutes, their view is totally blocked. So, again, this doesn't play into what you're talking about the charisma. But the lure of that, you know, when you're seeing the world through Karen's eyes, as you do in that Copa shot, this whole thing of this guy who gives his keys to a total stranger, because there's no valet parking at the Copa. He's an unofficial valet. He's going downstairs. Everybody knows him. The cook knows him. The chef knows him. He's handing like $20 bills to every. He might as well hand a $20 bill to the couple making out. He doesn't do it. And, you know, and he's being waited on like a sultan. And then the punchline is, well, what did you say you do? He says, I'm in construction.
Don't feel like you're in construction.
You know, you don't have the hand. Yeah. So I'm a union delegate. That's great. You know, so, but the glamour of that, the glamour and also the power, that's the thing. This is the thing, you know, the sociopathy is very interesting, because there's that scene where Henry pistol whips the guy from across the street. And, you know, we talk about women not reporting sexual assaults. And part of the reason they don't report sexual assaults is because there's nothing ever done about it. Here's a case. I mean, this wasn't made with an eye to commenting on contemporary society 30 years later, but it does have something to do with it. Here's a case where she says to her boyfriend, this guy tried to handle me. And within 20 minutes, that guy's no longer a problem. And he gives her the gun that he pistol whipped the guy with. And she says, you know, all my girlfriends would have turned around and had nothing to do with the guy after that. And she said, I have to admit, turned me on. And what turned her on? Not just the transgression, but the instant the instant effective use of power, that he gets what he wants. That's his thing. He's not a big shot. He doesn't live like a millionaire, but he gets what he wants when he wants it. And he just takes. And that transgression, that, especially in our society, capitalist society, where we see people being rewarded for nothing, just, you know, in a sense that almost seems arbitrary for people to have to work all the time, the suckers, as Henry calls them, but he just takes it. And that's fascinating. And there's a part of us, I think, especially in America, that wants that, that would like to have that license. Why can't we have that? So it speaks to that very strongly.
I'd like to come back to a point you raised earlier about the incredible transformative effect this movie had on Scorsese's career, that, you know, we now take for granted that, you know, he's somebody who has a lot of leverage to do projects, you know, is well known even among casual moviegoers, even if it's only to complain that he's not fulfilling his moral obligation to love comic book movies or whatever. But, you know, in 1990, he was in a difficult position. You know, the decade obviously started with Raging Bull, which was a great movie, but there's a great scene in Stephen Bock's book about Heaven's Gate where the head of UA is screening the movie and he comes up to him and said, "Mr. Scorsese, you're a great artist," in a way to convey, like, we're taking a huge bath on this one. And then The King of Comedies, although both Paul and I consider it to be one of his greatest movies, was neither a commercial or critical success at the time. Last Temptation is incredibly hard to get made. You know, The Color of Money is kind of a well-executed but impersonal movie, although it was probably what allowed Goodfellas to be created. But I was wondering if you could say a little about the sort of difficulty he had in the 80s and the way that, that Goodfellas kind of, you know, in a sense, saved his career and just put him in a completely different position in Hollywood.
Different people have different perspectives on this, but I think your through line there is relatively accurate. Let me just go through the different films, because this also has a lot to do with the Scorsese-De Niro dynamic. People assume that all the films they made together were the result of this blossoming, you know, ongoing collaboration. But there was every film they made together was done for a different reason and with a different dynamic. And with both Raging Bull and King of Comedy, those were projects that De Niro was very passionate about and that he had to talk Scorsese into. We go into a bit with the book. Scorsese does New York, New York, which is involves a great amount of effort and a great amount of time, and kind of leaves him in a place of huge despair and confusion. He begins doing drugs heavily at that time. He gets invited to do The Last Waltz, which pulls him out of that for a while, but he's still in a bad place, and the drug abuse gets worse. And finally, he's he moves into a house with Robbie Robertson. They're called the Vampires because they never go outside. They stay inside. They screen movies. They do drugs. And he meets Isabella Rossellini. That's a turning point for him, but not enough. And at Telluride, he goes into a complete collapse. He has to be helicoptered out of there, taken to New York. He's bleeding from every organ in his body except his eyeballs and his liver. And I'm not telling tales out of school. He wrote an account of this for the film publication Projections. And he's done. He feels done. And De Niro, when he's recuperating, De Niro comes in. He'd been talking about Raging Bull for a long time, and Scorsese resisted. And he comes to him and he says, "We can do this. We can do this." And as a favor to De Niro, he says, "Let's do it." And he puts everything he has into that movie. He says, "I'm going to make this movie in the United States, and then I'm done to Italy, and I'm going to make movies about the lives of the saints." Okay. And he said to me, that was the last time in his career working with studios, film studios, that UA, who got hit with Raging Bull, the much more catastrophic Heaven's Gate, and also Apocalypse Now. I mean, this was, you know, the triple threat that kind of ended the Easy Rider's Raging Bull age of filmmaking to a certain extent. But he said, you know, up until the point where the film, you know, flopped, he had great support from United Artists. And he says he never experienced that again, you know, in such a consistent way from then until now. Because for him, every film, to a certain extent, is a knockdown, drag-out fight, even with the status that was achieved through Goodfellas. But let's move on. Raging Bull doesn't do as well as it could. Scorsese's health, you know, he's kicked drugs, but his health is still shaky. He doesn't want to do canned comedy either. There's a draft of the script in De Niro's papers down at the University of Texas in Austin, and there's a note from De Niro on the front page, and it says, "Marty, why does everything have to be weird and violent?" Like, he just didn't want to go there again. But De Niro convinced him, and he did it, and it was a difficult shoot. That was it was during the post-production that he met Barbara DeFina, who he married, and who became his producer and remained his producer even after they were divorced in 1990, which was a great thing for the films, but maybe not a good thing for them as people, because she's an excellent producer, and she did a lot even after they were divorced on things like Casino, saved them a lot of money by filming in real casinos after hours as opposed to building casino sets. She's a very pragmatic and smart producer in that respect. But she starts working with him on the post-production of King of Comedy, and it's a terrible, arduous, painful process, and then the movie flops. De Niro takes it in stride. When I interviewed De Niro, he just says, "I had a good time." You know, he's going to go on, and he's going to make Midnight Run. He's going to be a big movie star. So after King of Comedy, it's just a debacle. He's untouchable. You know, he's a leper. And even he tells me that Pileggi's agent said to him, "You know, I didn't want Nick to do this film with you. You were poison." The novelist Mark Helprin, not to be confused with the distasteful political analyst Mark Helperin, Scorsese was developing Winter's Tale, which was eventually made into a disastrous film by Akiva Goldsman. But he was developing Winter's Tale, and Helprin sat down with him for lunch and said, "My agent doesn't want me to work with you. He says you're poison." These are the things that Scorsese remembers, and these are the things that he still talks about. He's, you know, he's never going to, his material comfort and his ability to get huge budgets is never going to mollify him in that respect. So, you know, he has to retrench after Canned Comedy. So he does an independent film. The only independent film he's made, after like Mean Streets and Boxcar Bertha and those early pictures, a film called After Hours. And Erwin Winkler, the producer of New York, New York and Raging Bull, visits him on the set and says, "Marty, don't you want to make a real movie again?" Nice, very nice. What happened though was that, you know, eventually they started working with studios again. They worked with Touchstone, which was a offshoot of Disney, and they structured a deal with them. And what they were going to do, one of the whole objects of The Color of Money was to prove to movie studios that Scorsese was going to not be profligate. He would not go over budget. He could deliver film on schedule and on budget and satisfactory to the studio powers that be. And that was Color of Money, which he speaks of not overtly disparaging, but when I talked to him about it, I said, that's a milder film. That's how he put it. That's a mild film. I think he feels like he was too obedient. There's something about Scorsese's personality that does like to rebel. He does like to stir the pot. He's not a yes man in terms of dealing with money guys. So you know, there's maybe some regret that he just was so nice. But then he got this opportunity. You know, Last Temptation had been kicking around a long time. There was a script, there was a cast, there was a whole thing. And, you know, it was Paramount that set it up. And then Barry Diller, the aesthetic tower of Jell-O, a man responsible for many, many bad decisions, who still walks among us and is making bad decisions that hopefully don't impinge upon us that much anymore. But Barry Diller decided not to make it. You know, Diller and Katzenberg were a thing at the time. And so Tom Pollock, who's a saint, one of the saints of film, was at Universal at the time and says, "Come over here. We'll let you make Last Temptation as a one-time deal." And they didn't even care for some reason that it was controversial and it wouldn't make money. I mean, they didn't care that much. Barbara DeFina told me it didn't matter how Last Temptation did. It was a one-off deal. Yes, it involved doing at some point in the future another film for Universal, but it was something that, you know, Pollock decided to rescue just because he was himself, and that was done. So they had discovered the material for Goodfellas during the making of Color of Money, but because Pollock then waved the Last Temptation flag in front of Marty, he had to run off and make that movie and then come back after having written with Nick Pileggi the script for Goodfellas and make Goodfellas then. And everybody, because Goodfellas was a property that everybody was interested in, Warner Brothers was very interested in it. CAA, Nick Pileggi's agent was with CAA. This was the heyday of Mike Ovitz, the fresh maker or the deal maker or whatever you want to call him, who loved putting all these various talents together and making dream projects. It was actually Ovitz who greased the wheels for Universal to take over the Last Temptation of Christ project because, you know, Ovitz said to Marty, what do you want to make? He said, I want to make Last Temptation. And he says, I'm going to make it happen. And he made it happen. So that was that. But Goodfellas was going to be a whole other thing. And the reason, you know, and when it did come out, it was a hit, but not a huge hit. But it also got into the culture very, very quickly. It sort of seeped into the loam of mainstream culture. And a year after it came out, every stand-up comedian was doing a Joe Pesci impression, and everybody was quoting the movie, and it seemed like a movie that everybody had seen. And so this was, you know, this was a time when you had, there was a momentum going on there. And also Hollywood, despite this being 30 years ago, which is in my frame of time, not a huge amount of time, but Hollywood was an entirely different place then. You know, the whole super agent thing was happening. Ovitz was, you know, for whatever reasons, I don't think Ovitz is a particularly enlightened person aesthetically, but he wanted to prove something in terms of sponsoring Scorsese, and he did. And so the deals that happened after Goodfellas, which were Cape Fear, a very big mainstream film, despite being difficult and in some respect distasteful. And I think up until Wolf of Wall Street, I think it was Scorsese's biggest box office success. Cape Fear, Casino. Casino, you know, by the time Nick Pileggi was working on the book about Ace Rothstein, a name changed from his real name, but, you know, writing that book about the fixer who became the head of a casino in Vegas and how the mob people just blew their chance with it. He actually, the book itself was such a hot property before publication, he was asked to stop writing the book so he could collaborate on the screenplay with Scorsese. So these were big movies, and they were movies that the studios really believed in because De Niro was a star, you know. Midnight Run had made him a really bankable person, you know. And Harry Ufflin, De Niro's agent, said, you know, around the time of Taxi Driver, De Niro will never be a movie star. He has too much integrity. And he's just too, you know, unusual a screen figure. But Midnight Run did that for him. And De Niro doesn't process his career that way. I said, you know, when Scorsese came to you to do Goodfellas, your position in Hollywood was a lot different than it was when you guys left off with King of Comedy. He said, how so? I said, well, you have more leverage. How do I have leverage? I'm like, you made Midnight Run. It was a huge hit. He says, yeah, you get more attention. I'm like, yeah, you get more money. I didn't say that enough. Yeah, this office we're sitting in on the seventh floor of a big building in Greenwich Avenue. You don't want to press it with the guy. And you know, I'm being frivolous here, but De Niro is very helpful, very pleasant, and very very accessible. But he doesn't process things the way we do in terms of him. He doesn't think about landmark films. You know, he thinks about what he's wearing because that's what he builds characters from the outside in. People talk about, people have a very strange idea of what method acting is, and they tend to think it's very psychological and very, you know, having to do with motivation. You know, speak to Stanislavski's idea that you have to, who are you and why am I here in terms of building character. But for De Niro, that does figure in, but it's also the rings, the watches, the tie,
the hair. Ace of Suits. Yeah, like all those, like the raspberry colored suits.
Yeah, everything. You know, I'm the Irishman. I'm here to take your money. And that's his first line in Goodfellas. And he has to live that from the exterior in.
Sure, I'll just ask a quick one. This seems it just strikes me that a kind of maybe interesting parallel in some way is the way that Goodfellas relates to Scorsese's career and the way that The Godfather relates to Brando's. You know, that Brando was kind of the pariah figure that nobody would work with and was considered impossible and essentially finished. And that movie just kind of saved him. And I don't know, I was just throwing that out there as something that might be a something to maybe think about in terms of what you're...
Well, there is a sense in which Henry and Scorsese are similar at that time. Scorsese said to Amy Taubin, the film critic, he said to her, "I want to be a player." In other words, he wanted his status at that time. He wanted his status in Hollywood to be maybe not the mogul status that Spielberg had achieved, but "I want to be a player. And how do I get to be a player?" And Henry Hill can't be a made man because he's not 100% Sicilian. Why can't Marty Scorsese be a mogul? In a sense, Scorsese is a mogul now because he has this, you know, he has this whole production company that he oversees that produces these documentaries and television shows. And but still, when it comes to making his own films, the films that he signs off on, he still finds it almost impossible. But the ambition at the time was the same. And, you know, Brando was not... The difference is Brando didn't have that ambition. Brando didn't give a shit. Brando had to be heck. All the good performances that Brando did in that period, Last Tango in Paris and The Godfather, were coming off a string of completely undistinguished films in which he just sort of sleepwalked through them. And in both cases of Tango and The Godfather, you know, the director had to hector him, just never let Brando out of their sight, and just sort of like, because he just, you know, if allowed to go into idle, he'd just lose interest. And certainly the films that he made in the wake of The Godfather and Last Tango, his asking price went up to the stratosphere. But, you know, he would literally phone it in to a certain extent. There's that funny and sad clip of Christopher Reeve on David Letterman talking about the experience of working with Brando on Superman and how profoundly disappointed that Reeve was, because Reeve had idolized him and thought that he had something important to impart to other actors. And he didn't care. He wasn't interested. The thing about Scorsese is he still cares. He never stopped caring. He's very passionate. He's very passionately involved with every camera setup. He's passionately involved with the actors. He gives everything while making a film. And that's why it was important for The Irishman to be able to shoot over a year, because he's 76 years old while he's making that. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting. You know, he's not ever going to get a 16mm camera on his shoulder and go out on the streets by himself. He can't go out on the streets by himself. You know, I've done panels with him, and it's kind of horrifying. I did a panel with him in 2011 at the Tribeca Film Festival, and with Suleiman Sisse and a scholar on African film, talking about world cinema. And I was instructed by my friend Kent Jones, who was supposed to do the panel and had to drop out, was kind enough to invite me. And after you have the talk, make sure you have a very short Q&A. I'm like, why very short, Kent? And sure enough, the first person who gets up there is like, because you have it's in an auditorium and they have a microphone on the person. "Mr. Scorsese, I just want to thank the panel, and I want to thank the other panelists. I just want to say, Mr. Scorsese, you've been so important to me. And will you look at my script?" And I'm like, ah! and by the end, you know, and then people start rushing the stage, and we can't leave through the aisle. They're clogging the aisle. We can't go through the aisle. We have to leave through an exit off the side of the stage where Scorsese's driver is waiting. And I say to him, "This is why we can't have nice things." And he says, "Yeah, ha ha." And he goes into his car, and the people disappear. I'm like David Hemmings in Blow Up when he has Jeff Beck's guitar and people are like about to kill him. But once he gets out in the alley, it's just another stupid piece of wood and he throws it away. So, you know, and I've seen people like, at a lunch for Wolf of Wall Street, chasing his SUV down the street, you know? It's like he's a creation of a city of Rupert Pupkins, you know? hilarious. You know, I can go with Jay Cox into an art gallery and just hang out all day long and have lunch with Farron Nemi and him at the Lexington candy store, and nobody cares, you know. But if it's Marty, it's all over. So he can't go out on the street with a camera, you know. The closest he did was the video he took in, the Instagram video he took inside of his house during this COVID pandemic, you know. So, you know, he's going to do these works on a big scale for big budgets, and he's going to be comfortable. And, but yeah, never not a fight. Even this new film with Leonardo DiCaprio. Leonardo DiCaprio is the only actor working nowadays where you can make a movie that costs $270 million and it'll make money. And yet he still had to go to Apple and you know, finesse a deal with two different studios to get the budget he needs for it. So there you go. And you know, it's funny because, you know, there was that film, The Revenant, that DiCaprio was in. And one of the financiers, the backers, was a guy named Arnold Milchin, whose earliest film, one of his earliest films was, he was one of the backers of King of Comedy. And he's an Israeli guy, a former Israeli arms dealer. And he got into the film business. He's done very well. And, you know, The Revenant, a film by Alejandro González Iñárritu, went hugely over budget. They literally, because of the snow situation, they literally moved the shoot went on so long, they had to move from Canada to Venezuela to get snow. I don't know how that works either. And it was $70 million over budget. And after the film came out, it did huge business because of DiCaprio. And it made a profit. And Arnon Milchin is talking to Variety. He says, oh, well, you know, it didn't bother me when the film went $70 million over budget because I believe in art, you know. And I was talking to somebody who at the time worked at one of the – made the film. And I asked him about that. I said, does Arnon Milchin really that have that much equanimity? He says, no. He wanted to string us up by our balls. And knowing his background, he could have. But once the box office came in, he was very mollified. So, you know, but that's the power of DiCaprio. DiCaprio, you know, DiCaprio's like, what's his name? Hyman Roth in The Godfather Part Two. He always makes money for his partners.
Thank you. That's really interesting. I got to bow out, but I hope you guys continue to have fun. See ya. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, Paul. See you soon.
Great talking with you.
Well, if I have time for one more question, I guess to take it in a different, a little bit of a different way, you know, this film was, you know, the great performance of Joe Pesci's career, or at least it's what he became the most known for, right?
Yeah, The Irishman is, yeah.
Yes, but I mean, yes, but in terms of a public persona, right?
Defining,
I mean,
absolutely, 100%, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. De Niro, okay, you know, this comes after Taxi Driver and it comes after Raging Bull, but still, it's one of the iconic performances. But what interests me a little bit is Leota, in the sense of he is this young guy, he's charismatic, he, you know, he's really the hero of the film, he has the most screen time, and yet his career doesn't go very far after this, right? I mean, when A Marriage Story came out last year and Leota was one of the lawyers, I was like, hey, he actually has like real work, you know, and not some bad commercial or part in a bad film. So I was wondering, you know, especially given that Scorsese tended to, like so many, you know, of the great directors, work with the same actors repeatedly, that Leota just sort of never really moved beyond this in any, in you know, to become the legend that a Pesci, a De Niro, or so many others did.
I can't really speak to that too much from actual knowledge. And I'll tell you why in a second. But one of the interesting things about Goodfellas is that the two principals, the male and female lead, were relatively unknown at the time. Ray Liotta had done that amazing film with Jonathan Demme, Something Wild, in which he's fantastic. And he does have in that film that knife edge of that grinning charm and absolute sociopathic brutality that is terrifying to watch. That doesn't come out as much in Henry. He's not as brutal, but he can be violent. And that's a stunning performance. And anybody who, you know, sees that movie understands why he's perfect as Henry Hill. And he thought he'd be perfect for Henry Hill too. I think the fact that he did that as an unknown, and it was such an indelible performance, actually maybe worked against him in the future, because he didn't have the opportunity to stretch out the way De Niro was able to. De Niro at a certain point just decided to break the mold and do an out and out comedy. And I don't think Liotta was afforded that opportunity. He's still a very fine actor, and he's magnificent in Marriage Story. And he's going to work on a film that Steven Soderbergh is going to be shooting later this month, and called Kill Switch. I didn't get to interview him. It was weird. I tried and I tried and I tried, just like Mick Jagger. And I approached his publicist, and at first his publicist was amenable. Then his publicist became non-amenable. His publicist got in touch with me, said, he's going to be in town for the New York Film Festival. We'll try and squeeze something in. No, he's just in there overnight. Then all of a sudden, the publicist just stopped answering my email. And I called the office and was told by an assistant, you are to communicate by email. I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm calling to tell you I'm not doing this anymore. And she hung up on me. So that was not successful. I talked to my agent, and he's like, well, Ray Liotta is represented by Gersh, our agency. I'll talk to his person and we'll get something going. And then nothing happens. And my agent said, I'm told it's not a good time. Okay. I know Soderbergh, I've acted in one of his movies, but I'm not going to be that guy, So that's that. I'm done. I'm not interviewing Ray Liotta. And that was a blow. Frankly, one nice thing about this book is that people read it and they're very satisfied, and they don't come up to me and say, hey, how come you didn't do this? So I'm hoping that question come up. But I'm being frank with you, because the question of Liotta is, I think my experience in failing to get an interview with him might speak also to he may be a kind of a personality that just is not, that doesn't have that kind of ambition to put himself forward anymore, that may have something to do with it. It's a shame too, because he's a great actor and he continues to do great work. But, there's also a thing that happens when you're a lead in a movie and then you have to go back to being a character actor. And some people don't like that. Richard Jenkins was able to do it. He's in The Visitor in 2007, but he knows it's a character lead, and then he goes back to doing character acting. But sometimes you're like, no, I'm going to do this. Like Laird Kruger, the 40s actor who was in horror films and so on and so forth, and he lost a ton of weight, and he's like, well, now I'm going to be a romantic lead, and it didn't happen, and he died of a heart attack from losing weight too quickly. All sorts of weird things happen in Hollywood. I have no real idea, but what happened with Lorraine Bracco is that, she's a great actor who found work in a different register, but a similar genre. Doing The Sopranos was a great thing for her, because, her character is, like Karen Hill to a certain extent, not neither of it nor in it, but outside of it, looking at it in a very particular way. Karen Hill becomes of it and in it, and up to the point where Ed McDonald says, hey, don't play Babe in the Woods with me, Karen. But as Dr. Melfi, there's that distance. But she's also got that ethnicity, got that sort of street smart kind of bearing that makes her, a good psychiatrist for a mob boss.
You're also interested, and I hadn't really thought of this, but you forget the extent to which Paul Sorvino was cast completely against type, that he's the singer, he's the big personality, the bon vivant. He's cast as this quiet, glowering figure who never says more than five words. So that, it seems natural, once you see these performances, it seems perfect. But my understanding, if I remember, he actually had to be talked into doing the role, and not unreasonably, not because he's a difficult person. He's like, this isn't for me. This isn't my personality. But there's something about the way that Scorsese's team just is able to see these performances that just seem just completely counterintuitive to the rest of his career. It's this kind of remarkable skill.
And he looks like a more, a slightly more handsome, he looks like he could be a mob boss. A little bit better looking, a little bit better with the self-care. But in those moments of repose, he has that mass and that when he has a face where he's not having any affect or not being voluble, when his face goes into repose, it's this very, the kind of guy who nods his orders to kill, you know? So I think, you know, Scorsese and the casting director, Ellen Lewis, definitely saw that watching him in his quiet moments in other films. Different weird characters. You see him in Day of the Dolphin, he's a complete goofball, you know, but just sitting down, right? He's got gravitas. Paulie needs that gravitas, not a profound gravitas of a thinker, but the gravitas of a guy who can have you killed just by nodding. Yeah.
Yeah, and you're pointing out that he had to have given the order to kill Tommy. That was, you know, it's implicit. It's not explicit, but that's pretty clearly it was, you know, which is, I think, interesting. Yeah.
The world rife with betrayal. This whole idea of your friends who have your back. Yeah, they have your back, and they're going to put a bullet in the back of your brain.
Exactly. Eric, did you have one more question before we wrap up?
You know, the only thing, and of course we could go into so much detail on this, and you do, but I guess if we're going to have one more question, you know, the issue of music in Scorsese's films and how powerful it is in Goodfellas. And I've always found it somewhat fascinating in that, you know, especially when he's using the big sort of classic rock songs of the late 60s, he's not really straying out of the very iconic songs, and to the point that Layla, you know, or Sunshine of Your Love, or certainly Gimme Shelter can almost be a cliche, and yet it's so effective in not only in Goodfellas, but in Casino and in other films. And so I know you had a long chapter about the music, and why do you think that Scorsese's use of pop music is just so amazingly effective, more so than possibly any other American filmmaker?
Well, it's a lot of different things at once. You know, I think in the May 11th scene where you have George Harrison's What Is Life and Muddy Waters, Mannish Boy, and
The Live Leaves, Magic Bus.
Yeah, Magic Bus and Harry Nilsson's Jump in the Fire. In that scene, the music and the image almost create a suite, and the music functions as a higher consciousness of what's going on in Henry's mind. But it's Henry's mind filtered through Scorsese's aesthetic, because these are all songs he loves. In the scene where De Niro's character Jimmy is contemplating killing Maury and Sunshine of Your Love plays, then it's a matter of rhythm. The drums and also the rhythm of the guitar riff, it's almost synchronized with De Niro's eye movements as the camera dollies in slow motion. You know, the camera's you know, examining him, and it's almost like the rhythm is sinking. And, you know, that was something that occurred to Scorsese very early on. And, you know, his rule for the film was you could have old songs relative to the time it's taking place, but you can't have a song that came out after the time it's taking place. So there was one Rolling Stone song that he wanted that came out after 1980, and that's why Live With Me came in instead. And I think Live With Me was arguably the better choice. But, you know, the rationales also vary. Like, you know, you point out, well, my mob guys didn't listen to psychedelic rock. True. But they're in this bar and there's a jukebox, so Sunshine of Your Love does become credible. If you look at the scenes in Mean Streets that take place at the bar, the jukebox music comes up and down, becomes part of the, you know, gets out of the diegesis. The actual story becomes the overscore, depending on the emotional content of the scene. As when De Niro's Johnny Boy shows up and Jumpin' Jack Flash, his theme song takes over the soundtrack. And the way Scorsese manipulates sound with the use of the songs throughout his filmography is one reason why this is very different than your standard needle drop. You know, not to disparage Wes Anderson, but his use of those rock songs is very much a much more straightforward mood thing, as is, in a lot of cases, Quentin Tarantino's. But with Scorsese's use of the music in Goodfellas, I think, is the peak of it. I think it reaches genius. Certainly, taking Layla, an anguished love song, and taking its coda and reconfiguring it to this twilight of the gods kind of thing is very counterintuitive, but he makes it work. I think also in Wolf of Wall Street, there's a lot, when they're having that debauch in Stratford Oakmont with the woman getting her head shaved and the strippers coming in, and it becomes this weird orgy of impotent men and semi hookers, and you have this weirdly reverberated mix of Howlin' Wolf's Smokestack Lightning. It's more than a mood, definitely.
Yeah, and I don't know how you can look at the expression on that woman's face and think that anything's being glamorized there, but
that's maybe the most violent scene in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, it really, and the other thing with The Wolf of Wall Street is the McConaughey, literally, 10 minutes into the movie, gives that dialogue about, even legitimate brokers are complete con artists. Like, it's all a scam. It's like, I don't know what you need to,
Whether you're Warren Buffett or Jimmy Buffett, nobody has any idea. That's what he says.
Yeah, exactly. So that's awesome.
It's right there.
So I know.
Half of my friend Nick Pinkerton and I did the commentary for Wolf of Wall Street, and it's a tough one to do because it's a 3-hour movie. That's why we did it as a duo, but maybe half the time we're going, see, it's right there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a good way to end it. Glenn, this has just been fantastic. Thank you so much. I hope listeners will check out Made Men, which is a fantastic book. I want to caution you, since you live in Carroll Gardens, if you walk down to Smith and Ninth, don't go in to get the apparel. Oh, yeah. I just avoid that. Don't turn, walk away. That's weird.
There's a very nice and legitimate bagel shop there.
That's good. So now it's safer to go down there. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate
it. Thank you.
And we look forward to seeing the discuss. We'll continue to discuss this book on various social media platforms after this. So thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
Take care. Yeah.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.